roadmap for a new wellness story. 7 Steps to Enhance Health and Longevity. Read by the author, Dr. David Kruger.
Welcome to Roadmap for a New Wellness Story, 7 Steps to Enhance Health and Longevity. Let's first talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. This will parallel the introduction and preface material in your workbook. Then we'll look at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change, and the 7-step roadmap process to create a new wellness story. Roadmap is the acronym for the 7 steps. We'll talk about your wellness story. I encourage you to do the exercises and work pages and the workbook to parallel my discussion. I put together some information from research in psychology, healthcare, neuroscience, quantum physics, applied with strategic coaching to guide you. Although we'll discuss application to wellness, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. It's the choice architecture of your daily life. First, a disclaimer. My mission, my hope, and my stretch goal. The disclaimer. I will not be offering advice about vitamins, supplements, how to exercise, or 1700 calorie diets. My mission is much more fundamental, to change the way you think, specifically to be a catalyst for you to examine your wellness story, how you write it, and how you can write a new one. My hope, to guide you to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life. What you do today can affect the quality and longevity of those tomorrows. My stretch goal, to have these 5 seminars and the workbook exercises and tools make a positive and powerful difference for you for the rest of your life. This is what I believe, that people don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise, to lose weight, or to stop smoking. And if a better diet were the answer, the 273rd new one in the last 6 months would have been enough. Why is change so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, how many do you think change their habits? Only 1 in 9. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but that wasn't enough to change minds. He died before people believed and changed. Changing behavior is difficult. What keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What makes it so difficult to change, even when someone's life depends on it? Data shows that driving while texting is more dangerous than driving while drunk, not just drinking. How many people does that stop? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and familiar. Another component of resistance is that our brains resist change. They're programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. Keep this question in mind. Why is change so difficult? We'll return to it and strategize about it. I want to guide you as you write your own wellness story. When you want to go someplace new, rather than give you directions, I'll teach you to read a map. I'll teach you the essentials to write and live a new wellness story rather than tell you what you should do or ghostwrite it for you. It's less immediately gratifying, but much more long-lasting and powerful. People are less likely to incorporate the stories of others into their own action agenda, even when they pay for them. Jeff Kindler, CEO of Pfizer, said, "The percent of prescriptions that get filled is about 50%, and less than 50% of those filled are complied with accurately. So it has to be your story. and you have to own it. The light on the dashboard appears that says Service Engine Now. If you go under the dashboard and pull out the bulb so the light doesn't shine, it creates an artificial sense of satisfaction that nothing is needed. Another term, denial. But once you know something, you can never not know it again. Denial is still a form of engagement, even though invisible above ground. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal, a story in itself, a story needing and begging to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. You have to have a new story to be inside before you can give up an old story. This guided journey is a clear, specific, stepwise program for change. The ROADMAP, the acronym for the 7 steps, is a proven system to help you recognize, own, assess, decide what to do, map changes, author new experiences, and program new identity. Your wellness story can make a difference for the rest of your life. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. An illustration of the impact of the mindset of belief. From a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those individuals who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a 3-year period. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in a 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, and even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. They lived into the negative belief of aging, or died into it. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You would do research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil more frequently, and do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing that it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Every little thing counts. Look later at the addendum, page A6, to see how 2 French fries can weigh 40 pounds. The average American, according to the Washington Post, spends over $100 more a year on footwear than on vegetables. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you read The Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning page XII. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. Wellness is an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So we must consistently assess. Wellness is not something that you began to plan at age 65 or even at 50. Rather, every choice you make each day writes your wellness story. Your new wellness story. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. More than anything else, people put off exercise, starting a diet, evaluating their retirement plan. What if you treated a task such as exercise with the same mindset as work? With work, you don't have to get up each day and debate about whether you will or won't work, whether you'll take off a couple of days or just skip it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate about it or consider yourself virtuous if you do decide to go. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, even full-time parenting. Exercise can be the same mindset, the default story, but it needs a plan and a commitment just like your business. That's why people need coaches. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge, in his book Younger Next Year, says that 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. A quote from Henry Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Researchers at the University of Vermont showed that even moderate physical activity improves mood. Even 20 minutes of exercise at moderate intensity results in an overall mood improvement of up to 12 hours after the exercise. Their conclusion from this study is that daily exercise can both improve mood and diminish stress from the day. Exercise becomes critical for both physical and emotional health. Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg summarizes his institute's findings. Exercise at the molecular level has an anti-aging effect. We're going to look at the process of change in an informed and systematic way. First, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps. The composite will provide a template, a roadmap, to guide and apply your wellness story. The power of story, some premises of your new wellness story. First, let's look at the power of story. Write this question down. What is my story? Think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in 1 sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Not your bio, your title, your role. Your plot. Then write this 2nd question. What is my wellness story? Consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions. This is not as easy as it may seem. I was discussing this concept with an internationally known self-help guru. His response was, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my story to myself in order to know what to change." Over the years, I've listened to different kinds of stories. In medicine, each symptom is a story, needing, begging to be listened to rather than silenced or disregarded. I'm still learning about the power of story in everything from some remarkable research to listening carefully to some extraordinary people. Here are some premises that our work together will be based on. 1. Plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what people look for and how they attribute meaning to what they experience. 2. We learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, who discovered DNA with Crick, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." We personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationship and assign causality. Or ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. 3. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and process. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process at the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict assumptions. 4. A life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for and how to perceive and process experiences. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. For example, Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he became conscious of the fact to say, "I can't seem to start a novel until the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, if the mother was still there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." 5. We believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. Someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though the circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. 6. We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies in order to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, and education. When the two anthropologists emerged after a year to compare notes, they expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, and achieved a unity and comfort with the apes. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony, remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, and never reached a harmony. The anthropologist couldn't understand the discrepant results or find any reasons. They puzzled for months, until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. His gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story than our story tells us. 7. A story can define possibility. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 12 months, over a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what is possible changes, reality then changes as well. 8. A story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill plus some expectations, a story. In the majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, one can create it. The story, in fact, generates a truth so powerful that it can even reverse the pharmacological effect of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie, a fiction that becomes a truth. A recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. And this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Medical research suggests that up to 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. 9. A story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is perceived to act on its creator. Here are some ways that we can see ourselves as the victims of the stories that we create rather than as the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. Here's another example of the power of story. A woman I know who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, "At one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked, and everybody got drunk." 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements, so don't take it personally. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make themselves feel better. What they want or don't want to own, what they disavow or project. You can never hit your own stride if you're running someone else's race. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. We crave a sense of coherence and purpose. Spirituality is the basic desire to find meaning and purpose in life. Left and right brain, reason and spirit, form a powerful combination. Merging spirituality and health integrates treatment of the whole person. Some demonstrated relationships of personality with wellness. Organizations that have integrated spirituality in the workplace have found that it furthered their goals. Lowered stress, blood pressure, and heart disease have been shown to correlate with spirituality. Empathy heals. Patients whose doctors show concern recover from colds faster. This is from research at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. There was a direct relationship between the physician's empathy level and the patient's level of a chemical that summons the immune system to fight toxins. 12. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. This one comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries. Let's return to the question about the difficulty of change. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even when it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued career, or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, "What are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual." It's a two-part answer. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable. It's just familiar, a default model. We repeat because we know how it will turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers firmly. Notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same and change your thumbs so the other is on top. How does that feel? A little awkward? Now, move your thumbs back to your original place. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. We'll talk later about how to program change. Comfort zones. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In fact, in the U.S., 80% of lottery winners file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. And part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist, Milton Erickson, told of a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path until the end of the day when the path was well worn despite its very circuitous route. No one started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well and are circuitous routes. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Not only do we actively construct stories, but our brain continually edits at the same time. An example is a classic study in which an audience is asked to watch several people dribbling and passing a basketball among themselves. Their job? To count the number of passes each person makes during a 1 minute period. Intense concentration is needed because the ball moves quickly among five people. Then, someone dressed in a gorilla suit crosses the floor, walks through the players, turns to the viewer, and thumps his chest in the middle of the screen, and then leaves. How many people saw such an obvious happening? Researchers Daniel Simons and Christopher Shabris found that consistently over 50% of people fail to even notice the gorilla. This inattentional blindness is our brain at work trying to construct meaningful and consistent narratives from an inconsistent world. Things that don't fit the storyline get unconsciously edited or simply fail to register as relevant. Listen for the power of story. Your brain can rewire. New experiences, practiced consistently, form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. Active choice. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from pools of contrasting behaviors: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, and behaved according to this assignment. So an introverted person, for example, would act as an extrovert for an entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern, eating or reading something they would never have done before. What do you think was the biggest change in the group? The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects had lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off, many continued to lose. This was not a diet, but a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale? Requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. It makes them aware that everything they do is a choice. In coaching, I call this story busting. The participants exercised choice. This process of conscious decision extended to other choices, such as what to eat and what not to. Coaches are choice architects to help a client be aware that a choice right now for the next moment is the story he or she is writing. It's not there until it's lived. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. If you want to understand something, try to change it. Here's an example, a vignette from Executive Mentor Coaching. Brian was working successfully at a new CEO position. 3 months earlier, he advanced from COO at another corporation. He was doing a great job in his first 100 days. One session, he departed from our discussion of success strategies to say he had a fear that he would somehow sabotage his new achievements. Then he said he regularly stopped at a convenience store to eat candy before he got home so his wife wouldn't see him. I asked how he decided to stop each time. He responded by calling it sneak eating and said he hadn't told his wife. I asked, "What do you say to yourself the instant you decide to sneak eat?" He wasn't sure. I pressed. I thought it was time to drive for the bucket. I wanted to know specifically the conversation he was having with himself that led to his conclusion to get the candy. He said he wasn't sure. He hadn't thought about it. Well, I already knew that. An impulse fuses urge with action to collapse the contemplative space where reason resides. There was no place for what's in my best interest. I wanted us to look at the frame-by-frame process that resulted in his choice to do something he really didn't feel was in his best interest, specifically the frame-by-frame conversation the instant he decided to make his choice. So I prompted, in other words, do you bargain with yourself to say, "I'll do better later"? Do you oppose your own authority to say, "I'll do whatever I want"? Or do you feel that some overwhelming urge hijacks your best judgment? Brian recognized a conversation with himself that went, "To hell with it, I'll eat whatever I want, no one's around to stop me." He recognized that the result was to abandon his principles. I noted that in the story he was writing, he farmed out his authority to his wife as if she were the obstacle. He kept the other half, the desire, as if he were getting away with something. He created the illusion that he triumphed because his wife didn't see him. We touched on his stress in being in a more ultimate authority role now than ever before in his life, his first CEO position. He acknowledged his choice to, at least at times temporarily, not be his own authority. His question was, "How do I get it back?" I said, "The question is not how do you get it back, but how do you not give it away? It's yours. You're the author of your story." I paused, then added, "Seems like you're not being loyal to yourself." He recognized he was writing a storyline he detested. I asked how he could convert his fear into an intention that was in his best interest. He quickly admitted he needed to take care of himself better, that he wasn't living up to his own ideals. He could then collaborate with me to make a specific plan with effective strategies for eating and exercise. We could then apply this process to expand his success in his company as well as in his life. Here are some principles that focus on facilitating change. A preface to writing a new wellness story. 1. Each person's life story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it may seem to be, at times, just the way things are. 2. Knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. 3. When people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis is that someone tells you what to do. We'll talk in a later seminar about how the brain lights up with an aha or insight experience and doesn't when receiving advice or directives. 4. Change is constant and inevitable. It is the resistance to change that generates most problems. We are most successful when we learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. 5. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue in order to specify progress. For example, when you feel overwhelmed with the amount of tasks, first clarify one issue that, if done today, would be progress. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. 6. Problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected, and correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally to come to the end of the past, does not create a blueprint for success. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something is a totally new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise. 7. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what is not will become evident and self-perpetuating. 8. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. The end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it well. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asks. "Where do you want to go?" responded the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 9. You need the correct paradigm. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model, a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory, not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often are not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. A dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. For example, if you read the anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead, or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. A current paradigm may reframe the excitement and trepidation of moving ahead in new territory as a signpost of progress. 10. Decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception, just like the filter on a camera alters the image that gets recorded by the camera. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on and off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. A destitute young housewife had almost no money. She couldn't afford a babysitter or a computer. But she had a story to tell, and she was determined to do it. She decided to write. As soon as she started writing, her mother dies at age 45 from multiple sclerosis. Her marriage to an abusive husband ends in a divorce. Shortly thereafter, she has a miscarriage. After that, she gets fired from her job and lives on government welfare. She takes her baby to a coffee shop in the middle of the afternoon and writes on a legal pad while her baby takes a nap. She does it every day for 4 years. Then, after much work, she finally found a publisher for Harry Potter. Thank you.